because it's the first time, I think, in 3 weeks that we have met, I'm going to take 4 or 5 minutes here and just do a refresher before we dive in. Because we left on a cliffhanger. Remember, we had Henry and we had Gregory. And Gregory had just left the entire empire in this pickle. And the question was, what was Henry going to do? So before we get there, let me just refresh memories. The papacy had become something of a pawn. It had happened slowly, but was expressed most clearly through the work of Benedict IX. He was the guy who I keep bringing up, not because I'm trying to vilify one particular person, but because he really was the lightning rod. He was the guy who was Pope 3 times, sold it once to his uncle. It was on the backside of that that everyone realized there needed to be reform. This couldn't continue the way that it was. And you have Otto, one of the first German kings, who decides, okay, we've got to do something different. I take the back, strike that. Not Otto, Henry. Henry III, who decides that we need to do something different. Henry III was called Henry the Pious, and he ends up the first one who crowns what they would call later a reform pope, someone who was trying to reform the institution of the church. That reform was largely influenced by one monastery system, and that was Cluny, because Cluny had, 200 years before that, seen the need for reform. And so she was more and more expert at trying to purge the church and get those people who would use it for power, political reasons, monetary reasons, to try and get all that away and get back to a pure spiritual church. So a Cluny Reform monk becomes your pope, and as a part of his cabinet was a man named Hildebrand. Hildebrand would come to power during Henry III's son's reign, Henry IV, Hildebrand would take the name Gregory. Gregory was such a force that all of the Reform popes became known as Gregorian Reform popes. Even the popes that preceded him now are considered by his name. Those who talk about the fall of the church sometimes talk about the fall of the church happening with two people, Constantine and Gregory. That's the sort of power that Gregory and the shadow that Gregory will cast over the church for his time going forward. When Henry is 6 years old, he is a child king. They take power away from the king. We've been tracing the arc of who has power, who can crown who can take the crown from who, and the church makes the rule that only they can put people in power. When Henry comes into power as an adult and he has a little bit of peace on one of his boundaries, he tries to raise up a bishop in Milan. It's a direct attack on the Pope. Milan's in his backyard, and the Pope rebukes him. Not long after, Henry finds himself in the middle of a war. Keep in mind, the Pope has an army. He can't fight 2 fronts. He repents, says, "I'm sorry," and the Pope forgives him, and all goes on. Once he gets peace again on his front, he tries the exact same thing. The exact same Bishop of Milan, the exact same guy, tries to put in that office. This time it goes back and forth. You remember the letter that Henry wrote to Hildebrand? When he called him to Hildebrand, or called him Hildebrand a false monk, and he told him to go to the bad place, right? For decency's sake, I won't say it. But you know, he told him to descend. And that got published over the entire kingdom, right? This is like, oh, I can't believe this. A king would tell a pope. And then Pope Gregory responds in kind. That was the last of those letters, the communications that I printed for you, where it was a prayer to Peter from the Pope, and the Pope was saying, "You are now, as an entire empire, no longer under any obligation to listen to the king. And King Henry thought that his position was pretty good. He had led the empire to relative peace, and all of those who were around, the land barons and whatnot in Germany, were relatively on his side. So this is a play on Henry's part to reclaim some of that power and to depose the Pope. So the Pope no longer has the ability to crown a king or to take the crown away from the king. The king wants that power back. He sees this is his chance. Strike while the iron is hot. Strikes. That's it. And the Pope responds and says, anyone who pays allegiance to the king is now a pagan. That's where we left off. So, Henry's court, when he meets the papal legates, what Henry expects is for the papal legates to stand up for Henry and to help Gregory to see that he has no choice but to listen to Henry. But that's not what happens. Instead, you have a court that runs to the papal legates, his representatives, and asks for absolution. In that moment, the power drastically shifts to Henry's side. And a council is called. Not a diet. What happens where the legates came together and representatives came together was a diet. Now a council, an honest-to-goodness, true council of the church is called. And it's called in Augsburg. Okay, in Germany. So, Henry knows that Gregory is on his way to Germany. And if he gets there, if he gets to Augsburg, more than likely what will happen is that he will be deposed as king and he will be killed. You don't have deposed kings just hanging around. Right? Deposed kings have a tendency to start rebellions and to try and get their power back. So if you depose a king, you better be ready to kill him. And Henry knows this. And so Henry engages in a bit of strategic political maneuvering. Do you remember way back at the beginning of this class when we talked about Ambrose and Theodosius? And Theodosius had authorized that slaughter at Thessalonica, and Ambrose had refused to let him into the church because of it. And so, and it lasted for like 8 months, and finally he put on sackcloth and ashes on his head, and Ambrose forgave him and allowed him into the church. Henry's going to do the exact same thing. He's going to put on nothing but sackcloth. He's going to put ashes over his head. But he has to be real strategic about where he meets the Pope. Oddly, even though the Pope is an Italian Pope and he reigns in Rome, he has more support in Germany. And oddly, though the emperor is German, he has more support in Italy. Don't ask. It's really complicated. And this is why I'm glad I'm not a professional historian, because I don't have to explain it to you. It's kind of red state, blue state thing going on. Okay? And so one of the cities that was for the king and had been for the king ever since the rise of the German lineage of kings, ever since Otto, was a place called Canossa. And so Henry is going to meet the Pope at Canossa. It's very snowy at Canossa when he meets the Pope there. And so he's in the snow, by some reports, 2 and 3 feet deep snow, without shoes on, without any clothes except sackcloth, wailing at the gates, and refusing all food. Now, the Pope can't ignore him. You can't just drive by the king lamenting out loud like that and wave. Give the princess wave and say, see ya, right? The people aren't going to let him get away with that. The people are for Henry. That doesn't necessarily mean that the Pope has to do what Henry is asking. But he can't slight Henry either. The people aren't real sure what to do. They're like the rest of the empire. They feel themselves stuck on the horns of this dilemma. Am I faithful to the king or am I faithful to the Pope? But they want the king to have a fair hearing. That's what the people seem like they want. So he can't just ignore him. And so he finds himself holed up in this tower of sorts for 3 days while Henry laments and laments and laments, while he refuses food, while he sits in the snow without any clothes but sackcloth. Now, if you were in his position, what would you do? Keep in mind, Henry has already repented once of this exact thing and said, "Oh, you're right. We have erred grievously." You remember that quote that we read? "We will listen to you in all matters. You have the right of the church and not us." And here he is. He's done the exact same thing. He has tried to play the entire empire against you, have you deposed, and maybe on the outside take your life. That's what he's done. What are you going to do? Well, Gregory sits for 3 days praying and thinking about this. And what he comes down to is his first and foremost job is the job of a priest. And as a priest, if Henry is genuinely repentant, he had no choice but to forgive him. Now, Gregory does a lot of things wrong, and we'll talk about a couple of them here in a minute. And he was super forceful. You know, he was a good organizer, good leader, even a good military leader. Last time we talked about him helping to lead the army in a siege and did a great job there. But he's got a lot of foibles. In this moment, I think 9 times out of 10, men choose their egos and power here. Not that they should, I think they do. And Gregory, in this moment, gives absolution. He forgives. And I think you've got to hold Gregory in some esteem for that. He had a chance here to quash, finally and utterly, this king who had been against him pretty much from the time he took the tiara. And he chose not to do it because he thought that's what Christ would have him commanded to do. So, Henry gets absolution and he goes back to his empire and back to his king, or back to his throne. However, by the time he gets back, what he's found is that his brother-in-law, a guy by the name of Rudolf, is leading a revolt against him. The life of a king. Rudolf is Henry's brother-in-law twice over. I don't know what that means exactly, right? I don't know how to draw that family genogram. I really don't. But I know that he's his brother-in-law twice over. Married sisters, I guess. I don't know. And it seems like Rudolf is going to win. It seems like he's got enough players on his side, and there are battles, very pitched battles. It's a civil war, basically, that's happening inside the boundaries of Germany. And it seems like Rudolf is going to be the victor. And in a moment where it seemed like Rudolf was undeniably going to win, Gregory changes his support. And instead of supporting the rightful king, he chooses to support Rudolf, an anti-king. There are anti-kings and there are anti-popes. Now, the only thing that makes you anti is that you lose. Right? That's the only thing that makes you an anti either one of those things. There's an old axiom inside of historical circles, which is history is written by the winners. Now, that's a little too harsh. Because the entire idea is that, you know, history is this really movable thing. And we know as Christians history isn't. It's got a shape and it's got a trajectory to it. However, there is a nugget of truth there. That if you won, if Rudolf had won and taken the throne, he would not be called an anti-king, he'd be a king. But unfortunately, he loses. And after he loses, the aftermath for Gregory is disastrous. People wanted to have an ethical, non-political pope. They're coming out of hundreds of years of political popes. Popes that had bought their way into that office. that had abused their power and abused the people. So what they wanted their hope upon, the reason why all of Germany really turned against Henry, was because here was this ethical guy. Yeah, he might have been a little bit bull in China shop, but you could respect him. He had integrity. And the moment he's seen as losing that integrity, rather than backing the genuine king, trying to back the guy who he thinks is going to win, in order not to lose his tiara, he loses everybody. When Henry regains his throne completely, he has Gregory deposed. And instead, he crowns a new pope, the bishop at Ravenna, who becomes Pope Clement III. Now, not genuine Pope Clement III. So if you go Google Pope Clement III, you're not going to find this guy. Instead, you have to go Google anti-Pope Clement III. Because he is never seen as having rightful authority from the church to become the pope. Keep in mind what we talked about last week, that the pope was no longer supposed to be put into office by the state. It was only, or the people. We had had state appointed and we had had people elected. Both had failed. And so we came to this process of a curia election, an election by peers, an election by the cardinal college. Because that did not happen, this result was voided. But for a while, Clement III would reign a couple years unopposed as the pope. Oddly, Clement III ends up reigning for, I think, 3 decades in Ravenna. And he is anti-pope during the time of 4 different actual popes. He oftentimes preaches blazing sermons against the papacy and against the real popes. And as a sign of defiance, when he dies, there's grand celebration for him. People love him. And in Ravenna, where people were imperialist, where they supported the crown, he was lauded. But a group of papists, people who support Roman Catholicism, end up coming in, exhuming his body, burning it, and then dumping the remains in the Tigris River. Right? That's the sort of acrimony that begins to develop between these popes and anti-pope lines. Now you've got kings and anti-kings, you've got popes and anti-popes. I mean, this whole thing looks like the world. This whole thing looks like a bunch of people who only care about power and money and land. You remember what Sinclair said last week when he said, if you wanted to be well taken care of, you went into the priesthood, you went into the church. At this point, people were making a killing by going into the church. And even if you didn't become a bishop, even if you didn't become a cardinal, if you didn't become one of these guys that could live the lavish lifestyle, you could at least have all your food and your room and board paid for. You would probably be allowed to go get drunk as often as you want to, and people were going to turn a blind eye when you visited the brothels. That's what happened for most of the monasteries and most of the people that were in that system at that time. So you have this anti-pope. And during this time of this anti-pope, you still have Gregory, deposed Gregory, who's holed himself up in Rome. He holds himself up in a place called the Castle of the High Angel, I believe, is what its English translation is. And if I tried to say it in Italian, I would just butcher it. I'll try it. It's Castle Sant'Angelo, maybe Church of the... whatever. He holds himself up in a castle in Rome. That's what you need to know. And he comes under attack And Rome itself is sieged for months. At one point, Henry leads the charge to try and take Rome, though he later leaves. And the only way that Gregory survives is that the Normans come and rescue him. Remember how he was over by Cluny? He was influenced by the original Cluny monastery. That's how he came into power, was because he could talk them and talk the papacy. He was kind of an intermediary there. Well, the Cluny monastery was in the territory of the Normans. The Normans were the enemies of the Eastern Empire and the enemies of the Western Empire. They're just against the empire. And so they come and they rescue Pope Gregory, kind of middle of the night, ship, come and get him on the ship and rescue him and get him out of there. He dies a month later. But not before issuing a letter imploring all of Christendom to fight against the emperor. From this point, for the next couple of centuries, the genuine papal line became known as the anti-imperialist line because of Gregory's declaration that the church should resist the emperor. After he dies, it takes a little while to sort out everything. But the guy who kind of rises to the top is a guy by the name of Otto. He's French. He's not German, unlike the Otto of Germany that we met. And this guy is a very politically savvy reformer. So he's still a reformer. He's still seen in the line of the Gregorian Reform popes. But instead of being so fiery, instead of being so in your face, he's very political. He knows how to cast a vision and get people enrolled. He takes the name of Urban II. He allies himself with the Normans, though he doesn't alienate necessarily either the Eastern or Western Empire when he does it, which is really a display of his ability to be a statesman, that he could do that. He excommunicates both Henry and Clement. This means that Urban II is the second pope to excommunicate Henry. Okay? Urban II's successor, Paschal II, would also excommunicate Henry. Henry is the only person in history to be excommunicated by three separate popes. And because he got excommunicated multiple times by a couple of those, he gets excommunicated a grand total of like five times. I don't know what that means other than he's super duper excommunicated. You can't be any more excommunicated than Henry. Urban calls for a series of synods. Again, they're not councils. They're synods. They're smaller church functions, regional church functions, not meant to come to handle a heresy, but to handle some sort of church business. And at these synods, he's able to rally people. Again, he seems ethical. He seems like he has integrity. He talks about the removal of simony, the removal of investiture, which again is the ability for state powers to put people in church locations, the importance of celibacy, and the importance of church power above temporal power. He wins back the popular vote. people are back on the side of the Pope again after the end of Gregory. Now, Urban II, his name may sound familiar to you. Maybe it doesn't. But to some of you it might. And the reason his name may sound familiar to you is because on the back of your handout, is what he is most famous for. Urban II is the one who preaches the very first crusade. I told you, he is a visionary. And he is able to cast a vision and to enroll people and to get them to execute. Now, in the original version of this class, we would now take 2 whole weeks to talk about the crusades. We don't have that time. So we're not going to talk about the crusades. But let me highlight a few things. First, I just want you to see the orator that he is, his ability to kind of move people, and why the Crusades become the issue for the next 150 to 200 years. Because now we have to do the stone across the lake sort of thing where we just get to touch, touch, and move. We got to go. So what has happened is that the pilgrimage that Christians would go on, often to the Holy Land, in order to get some of that sin removed from them. We talked about it again last week with Sinclair. It gets to a whole different level by the time you get to indulgences. Okay, indulgences is next level. This is in between, when it's not penance, but there's something you're about to be able to do to work off sin. So hear what he says. And I'm just going to read the bold parts for you. All who die by the way, whether by land or by sea, or in battle against the pagans, shall have immediate remission of sins. Wow. Wow. You go to war for the church and you are an instant saint. Think about how powerful that is. Especially when you have felt years and generations of, I may end up in purgatory. I may be a believer, but I may have to spend millennia in purgatory. By the way, if you do Google searches on the depictions of purgatory in the medieval time, it's not what it is now. Right? I remember, it feels like before I was converted, but I don't know. Family Guy, right? Every once in a while I watch Family Guy, and there's one where it's like, where are we going to go? They're talking about vacations. You know, no, we've done this, no, we've done this, no, we've done this. And then purgatory comes up, and they're all just kind of floating in this white space, doing like this, right? No, check that off, right? That's what purgatory has come to be for us modernly, is just this stasis waiting place. That is not what an 11th century Christian would have thought of as purgatory. You go find reliefs, pictures, and paintings. Purgatory looks like hell. It has fire and pain. It was meant to be the refining place that made you a saint. It's where you actually had to work off part of your sin. And that sin needed God's justice, which took the form of something that looked like hell. So, you're in a place where for millennia, you might be in hell. Or you get to go on a crusade and guarantee yourself a one-way ticket to heaven. Wow. The first crusade is overwhelmingly the most successful crusade. This I grant them through the power of God, with which I am invested. Let those who have been accustomed unjustly to wage private warfare against the faithful now go against the infidels, and end with victory this war which should have begun long ago. Let me pause for a second. It's been hundreds of years since the Muslim tribes had been allied together and been attacking those who had been going to Jerusalem. So he's trying to tell you, we should have taken care of this problem when it was a smaller problem hundreds of years ago, and our people wouldn't have suffered and died. Okay? And he's also taking a shot at those, there's a whole bunch of civil war that we've just come out of. He's taking a shot at them. Hey, those of you who are used to practicing war in front of each other or against one another, now let's deploy that for kingdom ends. Let those who for a long time have been robbers now become knights. Let those who have been fighting against their brothers and relatives now fight in a proper way against the barbarians. Let those who have been serving as mercenaries for small pay now obtain the eternal reward. Let those who have been wearing themselves out in both body and soul now work for a double honor. Behold, on this side will be the sorrowful and the poor. In other words, the people who don't go on crusades. On that side, the rich. On this side, the enemies of the Lord. On that, His friends. That's a powerful sermon. A wrong one, but powerful. And Urban starts what will turn out to be 9 major crusades and a number of various smaller crusades. Those crusades will wear the empire out. Think about this for a second. You and I, when we have friends and family go to war, we want them home inside of 18 months. You push it longer than 18 months, and you get a really unhappy base of people. This was going to go on for 150 years. It wore out generation after generation after generation. And so what you have as a result is the rise of nationalism. A proto-nationalism to what we would see later, post-Reformation. But all of a sudden you have people that think, do we really need to be in the interest of the empire? Do we really need to be in the interest of the church? Can't we be for the interest of our state? You have different kings leading different groups, English kings, French kings, German kings, squires, knights, all kinds of people leading groups on crusades. Why do we need to be for them? Instead, why can't we just be for us? Do we need to be doing this crusade in the first place? Why are we sending our sons to die? Does this make any sense whatsoever? That happens for 150 years. And as that begins to happen, you begin to see countries more formalize. And as countries more formalize, treaties begin to more formalize, alliances begin to more formalize, and that cardinal curia, that group of electorate, begins more and more to harden and crystallize as well. So you remember we talked about how Germany, Italy, France, those three, you're going to see those countries conflicting with each other throughout time, especially up to the Reformation. You begin to get groups and times when the Curia is controlled by a predominantly French group. And so a French pope will be elected. And that really offends the Italians. And the Italians begin to get and muster support. And all of a sudden there's an Italian pope or a series of Italian popes. And that alienates the Germans. And the Germans and the French ally together to try and get more other people. So they get their guy in play. Very political. Again, people begin to lose their faith in the church. That she could be run with any sort of integrity, that she could use her resources well, that she could shepherd her people and not cause them to just die for a cause they weren't sure about in the first place. That is the context of the next 200 years. Like I said, we're skipping stones. Because we are going to run up all the way to 1294. So we've just come out of 1095. 1095 is when the first crusade is authorized by Urban II. And now we're up to 1294. We've cruised through 200 years. But it's one of those, you know, which state group had the most power moments, in which there had been a bit of a stalemate. And there was a stalemate even inside Italy itself. There were two large, powerful families, and it was the Colonna and Orsini families, who had a number of popes in their family. And so they would often split the Italian vote. It was kind of like what Ross Perot did to the Republicans. You remember this? And when George Bush ran the second time, and then Ross Perot popped up, and like half Republicans voted here and half Republicans voted there, and then so you ended up with a Democrat. That's sort of what happens. You get these fractures, these family fractures. In the midst of these family fractures, other interlopers end up getting elected. Well, you have one of those. And the Italians decide to ally with one another to elect a guy named Boniface VIII, who was a fiery Italian. Are there any other types, really? But he was particularly fiery. And during this time, a bishop in France was put on trial. Again, keep in mind the geopolitical distinctions. You've got an Italian pope, so of course it's France who puts someone on trial, right? Because France isn't in power. If there was a French pope, probably wouldn't have happened. But a French court takes an Italian bishop to trial for not paying taxes. No bishop, no church paid taxes. Okay, this was not a regular thing. Instead, the French court was making an example. And what they said was, if you can tax us for your war, because they were increasing the amount that they expected nations to pay them in order to help pay for the Crusades, if you can tax us for your war, we can tax you for ours. Because the Normans were at war with the English. Because the French and the English are always at war. Boniface gets angry. And he issues his Unum Sanctum, which reads in part, "It is altogether necessary to salvation for every human creature to be subject to the Roman pontiff." It's now in words what had been operating basically for hundreds of years. You may be king, you may have subjects, but as pope, every human being on the face of the earth is my subject. Now, the Eastern Church probably didn't take very kindly to that. And the French court definitely did not take very kindly to that. And so the French king, Philip IV, had the Pope kidnapped. 1303. And held hostage in a town called Anagni. Now, what's again weird about this is that he has them kidnapped and taken to an Italian town. Right? You would think that because he's an Italian pope that you would take him somewhere, but again, it's blue state, red state. He's held for 3 days. He's beaten and nearly executed. This is the pope. You are arresting, holding hostage, and beating the pope. That is the level of acrimony we're talking about between the king and the pope at this point. The papacy sends in like a SEAL team, you know, special operations SEAL team into the tower, rescue him. It almost goes sideways, but they actually get him out. He dies a month later. Some say it was because of the injuries he suffered. Others say he died of humiliation and shame. I'll let you be the judge. His successor, another Italian, Benedict the 11th, he backed down from this unum sanctum. He tried to ratchet this whole thing down a little bit. Right? But he dies suddenly after only 8 months of reign. Curiously, he dies within a month of the Curia becoming French-controlled. A little suspicious. Poison is suspected, but the French now elect a French pope named Clement V. Clement V is afraid of reprisals. Keep in mind, you've just had two Italian popes back to back. One beaten and nearly executed who dies 1 month later. The other one who's only around for 8 months and happens to die mysteriously, though he seemed to be in otherwise good health as soon as the French get control of the Curia. He's a French pope. He does not want to go to Italy. So instead, he sets up his reign at Avignon. Anyone ever been to Avignon? There's always someone who's been to Avignon. I hear it's beautiful. It's on the bucket list for me. Every time I teach this and I kind of go back through it and remind myself every time, I think I want to go there and I want to see it. But it's supposed to be massively impressive. Beautiful castle. It's actually more than one castle. It's two castles built right next to each other with a common wall in the middle. Because the popes tried to outdo one another. That's why. Avignon becomes the symbol of opulence. Sometimes the popes at Avignon are called the Babylonian captivity of the papacy because they're in Avignon for 67 years, nearly the 70 years of the exile. They were so indulgent, they made the French court look modest. And if you've never read any reports on the French court, that is hard to do. It became known for four things. One, it became known for its dress. Now, the great thing about this period is once you have the papacy moving from Rome to France, and you've got these more solidified countries, you have countries sending representatives to figure this whole thing out. What happened here? What is going on? And what are our allegiance? And, you know, we have these coffers for these monasteries and churches. Where are they supposed to be going? Is it supposed to be going to Rome or is it supposed to be going here? So you've got a lot of really good investigative reporting that you can read. So you're not just taking one person's view on it or another person's view. We've gone from Eusebius, which he's the only one who reports on a lot of things that happened in the first three centuries, where it's kind of black and white, to technicolor, because we can see all of these different pieces come together and multiple voices corroborate one another. So one of the things that gets corroborated is their dress is so skimpy it offends the English. Whenever the English go to the papacy and see the court there, they are offended by it. They write long letters talking about the indecency of the papal court. Second, it's known for its wine. When they leave Avignon and go back to Rome, they take multiple ships with them. I think it's like 36 ships of stuff that will go with them originally. And almost one whole ship is just barrels of wine. Just barrels of wine. When they leave, more of the bishops lament the wine than anything else. Supposedly there are audible cries over the wine for months. Second, it's known for its opulence, that there are those two castles, like I said, one right next to each other. There's a planning error, and the popes want to outdo one another, and so you end up with two castles in one space. You really don't get that anywhere else. But the church had the money to pay for it. And that makes people angry. It's also known for its corruption. There aren't many theological issues that are taken on or resolved during this period. They become a bit of a joke again. They seem more preoccupied with raising money, purportedly to help with these crusades, but oftentimes it seems just to support their own lifestyle. And there are even reports, now this one is uncorroborated, so you got to be careful, but there's one report that there was a private brothel in Avignon just for the Pope and his court. Right? That is the level of opulence that you get with Avignon. It no longer is concerned at all with theological issues. It seems like a mirror of the world. In fact, it's right next door to the French court, and it seems to be more concerned about outdoing the French court than it does about evangelizing people to Christ. That's where we'll pick up next week, when we'll talk about the move back to Rome. Let me close this in prayer. Heavenly Father, thank you again for your people. Thank you that you are the hope and stay of your church, that even in times when it is bewildering how she acts, yet you keep her. You are the one who is always shepherding her, guiding her, making sure that she is safe. We ask that you would do that with us, that you would shepherd us as your believers, that is specifically this church at First Pres, we would be those who love you and love you more than the world, who would be willing to divest ourselves of self-interest, that you and you alone would be glorified and honored. So do that. Get all the glory and honor through us. We ask and pray in Jesus' name. Amen.